trust. It's the people in charge we're not sure about.
Okay, here we are. Episode 9 of the In Tech We Trust podcast. Yeah, baby! Just the three of us this week. Myself, HDL, who did an awesome job on the show all about OpenStack last week, and Gabriel Chapman. So let's have a quick go around the table, so to speak. Gabriel, what have you been up to?
I've been a traveling Wilbury. I spent the last month on the road, basically Monday through Saturday, every week for the last 4 weeks, just going out, customer events. Did World Europe, obviously. I was there, missed the show. Then I had, you know, a week of training in San Jose. I had a week of customers on the East Coast, came home for a day, went back to Atlanta, Philadelphia, back to San Jose, where I had an engagement with Apple. It's been a crazy whirlwind of work-related travel that's basically precluded me from being a part of the podcast for the last month.
Sounds brutal. And we've missed you.
No worries.
Okay. Hans, I've got to say, what a cracking job you did on the show last week. What have you been up to?
I did nothing on that show, man.
Give over.
I just had two amazing guests. You
they
have to
amazing.
Admit that. I mean, it was a great show. I loved it. It was a hassle to get it organized. I mean, all you guys dropping off at the last minute. We actually, so for the listeners, we usually record on Wednesday night. That's 11 p.m. for Nigel, midnight for me, and like 3 p.m. for Mark and 6 for Ricky, if I'm not mistaken. So that's why when we record, and everyone was dropping through the day on Wednesday. So I was trying to find new guests, which didn't work out. And in the end, we managed to record Thursday night with Caroline, who was still in London, and Melissa. It was a great podcast. I had a lot of fun. Great geeks. Know a lot. They really know what they're talking about. It was awesome. And I mean, I made my confession as it being really still new to OpenStack, and I'm going to make some commitments in the next year, getting in there, trying to get hands on. I really want to get some hands on in the next few weeks and months. Next to that, in the last 2 weeks, have been brutal for me. I'm doing, and I'm sorry, I cannot disclose the customer. If I do, I would never have another job again. But I'm doing a data protection audit for a localized part of a very international company, and it's going horribly wrong. I'm supposed to be an expert, and I haven't done a single system restore in 2 weeks now.
A data protection audit, did you say?
Yes. Yeah, so, well, basically, they just asked me to come in and tell me, here is a, this was the setup, right? I was told I was going to get the procedure to do a system restore, and then you get 2 weeks to test all the machines.
Like, okay.
That was all I was asked for. I've been there since last Monday, and I haven't restored a single machine till today. I even blogged my notes today.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah,
it was horrible. So they're doing in-guest agent-based system restores horribly.
I think I'd rather pull my own teeth out. I'm not kidding you. That sounds awful. A data
yes.
protection audit just at that high level says to me, oh, that is a horrible sounding piece of work. Just jumping back to the podcast though. Awesome job last week. I really don't think it should make a difference, but I thought it was just amazing that the two guests were women and they were proper Uber techies as well. It shouldn't make a difference, but I thought that added an extra cool factor to it because we definitely need more women in tech and more techie women.
Yeah, well, I don't know if you've seen it, but I have this little shtick that I'm doing for the last couple of weeks and months. When I go to an event, there's this button that has been coined first by the Zerto team, by the way, and that says, I'm not a booth babe, ask me a question. And we're bringing this to the broad audience. Wrote a blog post about it. Actually talked today with the people of Zerto. We're going to expand that more to make it available for everyone. I think a lot of it is awareness, and we should not be surprised.
Yeah, so if I can find a decent woman in tech who would like to come and be on the podcast regularly, then I think we'll fire you, Hans, and we'll put her in your place.
Well, now, thank you for that.
It was awesome, though. Really good show. If any of the listeners haven't listened to it, it's cracking content on OpenStack. And great guests, and you did a great job hosting it, Hans.
Thanks.
But I think maybe enough patting on the back. Before we go into the content of the show, though, you have been doing a few other things for the podcast on the side, Hans, around social media like LinkedIn and Facebook.
Yeah.
Do you just want to give the listeners just a quick primer on that?
Well, yeah, we started slow with just some just having a Twitter account, and we went and have the blog post out. Slowly we're adding small parts to the podcast, just seeing what happens. We had the Facebook page that is online, of which we're almost at about a hundred.
No, we're 1 million.
Million likes. So we're using the Facebook page today just for spreading out the message and maybe some banter and free commenting. But we have added a LinkedIn group this week or last week, actually. And I'm taking one or two parts out of the podcast, because this is only just three or four of us talking to each other. And I would like to get the discussion beyond just our visions and have people comment to what we said. So I will rephrase one or two questions in the week after the show into a discussion on the LinkedIn group. So feel free to chime in there. And maybe we'll have more. I don't know which platforms work best for us. We're all part marketers, part bloggers, part techies. So let me see if LinkedIn works for us as a discussion location.
It reminds me, LinkedIn used to be a really great place for groups and group discussion for a long time, and then it got really spam heavy and it went away from that. It's nice that, you know, I'm starting to see less of the spam commentary job posting type stuff that gets into those groups the way it used to. And I've seen real good interaction from a lot of disparate viewpoints within the LinkedIn group. Whereas the only Facebook, it's mostly friends. LinkedIn, I mean, we have professional networks that are huge.
Yeah, so that's why I'm using LinkedIn for the discussions. That I do like to keep it a little bit professional. The only problem I have with LinkedIn is that LinkedIn as such is becoming a very marketing-ish platform. And I hope that the discussion group is still how it was run in discussion groups in the earlier days. As soon as I see that it's not working at all, we'll find a nicer place to have open discussions, because I do want to get the discussion beyond just a recording as such.
Ah, I totally agree. So if you're a fan of the podcast, come and join us on Facebook and LinkedIn and bust a few moves with us there. Is that the message?
Yep.
All right then, so into some news and some technical content then. Bunch of stuff going on this week. I think first off, we'll talk about David Flynn, the Fusion.io co-founder, who's currently at Primary Data. So he was the CEO and he stepped, I don't know, is this backwards or sideways or what, to be the chief technology officer instead?
I think it's a good move. Two things. I think he can use some time to get some new credit from the industry. He lost a lot of credit at the end at Fusion as a CEO. And he is a techie. So he used to be CTO previously, now stepping, I'm not sure that it's stepping back. I mean, it's the same level of CEO, CTO. So he's going back into tech, and he's taking his former COO, who should know one or two things about organizing a company, into the CEO role. I hope the COO has enough flair to become a CEO, but I think it's a really good move for him to go back to the roots of technology as such.
I think it shows that he's a true techie at heart, doesn't it? And I think certainly for somebody like me, I guess you can't step forward from being a CEO. There's nowhere further to go. But it's definitely not a backward step, not from a techie perspective, right? He's no doubt more comfortable being a chief technology officer. And I tell you what, if I could choose between being a CEO or a CTO, I think from the fun side of things, you don't know, maybe you get paid more or there's more perks to be a CEO sometimes. but from a fun side and to be involved in the tech and just, that's almost all you do. I'd much prefer to be a CTO than a CEO.
Yeah, exactly.
As a CEO, there's a lot less sleep at a startup. You know,
oh, I bet.
Those guys are driven and driven hard. I mean, I come in from my past company at Simplivity. I know that I could probably hop on the phone and talk to our CEO at pretty much any time of the day, 24/7. You know, I'd had numerous calls on Sundays at, you know, 2 p.m. till 1 a.m. When you're in that particular space, you know, your life, you live, you breathe, you are the company until it gets to a place where you can delineate or at least delegate more of the day-to-day operations to others. But when you're sub 50, sub 100 employees, I mean, it's a very long sprint marathon.
Yeah. I don't recall really what who wrote it, but there was an article earlier this year, and it was, as a CEO, you have to fire yourself on a weekly basis, which means in the beginning of the company, you do everything from HR to PR to marketing to maybe developing. And every time you have to question yourself, what is the next thing I can give away to someone else?
Yeah. But I guess as CEO, you are the main person that's driving that company, if you will. And in that respect, I guess moving to be CTO is maybe a little bit of a backward step, just in that perspective, right? In that you're no longer the main man in driving the company. Now, I've not worked at a startup before, but Gabriel, you have. What kind of influence does a CTO have on the direction of a company?
You know, it depends. A lot of times the CTO or the CIO or whatever, you know, flavor you want to call it, can be the real driving force behind getting the product formulated into market. And I've seen several companies where the first people or the first person who came in as the CTO per se wasn't the person that was there with them a year or two later. Sometimes you get people who are serial product deliverers, right? They want to get they'll love the challenge of, you know, designing a product, taking it to market, and then they hand it off to the team that has to go out and sell it, and that's all they want to do. And then there's others who are CEOs themselves who have a very technical side to themselves, but don't necessarily have the chops to foster a company forward in taking it to market, taking it to IPO, and they step into a CTO role that allows them to focus more on the technical side where, you know, maybe that was their strong suit and less of the day-to-day minutiae of running the organization. I mean, you look at, you know, what primary data is. I mean, there's Rick White. I believe he was at Fusion.io early as well. And, you know, they didn't really spend a whole lot of time. You know, David Flynn didn't spend a lot of time going from Fusion.io. I mean, he was like not even a couple months, it seemed like, and he was already at primary data with people he had worked with in the past. So, you know, it's... I'm interested in that story and how quickly they were able to bring a product to market, or at least get a Series B round of about $50 million last October, and in such a quick fashion for an industry that's still somewhat murky in quote-unquote storage virtualization.
I imagine guys at that kind of level, though, even though they may be in a leading position at one company, they're having conversations all the time with everybody else around the industry, and they must be bouncing crazy ideas off the wall all the time. And they've probably always got one or two things on the back burner that they think, well, once I exit this company, I could start this, I could start that. And they probably have, you know, fairly detailed discussions around, well, what could we do next? Who could we pull in? And these guys are serial guys at doing that, right? And that's got to be a buzz, a bit like a drug, you know?
No, I would definitely agree. I mean, I think anybody who spent a significant amount of time in a startup and has brought a product to market and been successful at it, you know, you're continually chasing the next bigger, better thing. I think also, you know, we can't downplay the influence of the VCs themselves who have track records of success with specific people. You know, you look at Moshe and I, who's had successful products, and he gets probably input from VCs that he's worked with in the past about, well, here's a new upcoming technology. We need somebody to go in there and kind of focus and shape this. And that very well could have been what this is as well, where the investors had worked with Flynn or somebody like him in the past and said, hey, well, here's a product that's promising. They need a little bit of assistance to get over the hump and get to this next level. Why don't you come in and manage this for the next year or so? And that's where you get to kind of watch and see what happens.
Yeah, you know, mentioning Moshe there just makes me think. So Primary Data have also got an Israeli influence in the company. And I'm astounded all the time. The number of startups in the tech space, I think especially the storage space, that have offices in Israel.
It's a huge incubator.
Israeli companies. It's awesome for a country of their size, right? I mean, what is the deal with that? Is there something in the water there, as we would say in the UK?
Well, Tel Aviv is the Silicon Valley of the Middle East.
Sure, I get that, but why?
Good universities, definitely a focused group of people, right? Anybody I've worked with, I mean, I've worked with several Israeli people in the past. I'm not trying to broad stroke this, but very driven and very focused, and they, you know, it's very no nonsense in getting the task done, and I think it's something that's kind of in. In their DNA in that part, that particular area where, they really get down and drive some of these things. And that's where you've seen some really amazing technologies come out of there. And it's not something that, you see here. You see a lot of that in the Valley, but it's a little different, right? You see mature startups coming out of there, out of Israel. I mean, products that are ready to go to market almost when they do their B round or when they come out of stealth. Now they just need the sales and marketing teams that they go to the U.S. for.
Exactly. It's even called the Tel Aviv model, by the way. It's very short, but really focused on execution, on technology, building that first usable product, and then bringing it to the States for marketing and expansion. It really, it is even called that way, the Tel Aviv model.
Yeah. You know, I have spoken to some of the guys at these Israeli startups and asked them these very same questions. And one of the things that keeps coming up is that they have some form of national service over there where everybody, when they become a certain age, goes and does military service. And they say things like, you've got young guys and ladies coming through the system, okay? And they're young and they're put in charge of important equipment, important teams, and they're forced to, learn to deal with difficult and complex situations and to innovate. And then they also say as well, as a nation, they're surrounded on all sides by people that are none too favorable towards them, let's just say. So they constantly have to innovate. And wow, some awesome companies come out as a, based off of that. And also on the topic of Israeli companies and Israeli startups, right? Stratascale. They've just raised, I think, $32 million now. Hyper-converged company. I've never heard of them.
Me neither.
Nobody has.
What's with that? How can you raise $32 million and nobody's heard of you? Hello, guys. I'll have some of that. Thanks very much.
It was really weird seeing that news coming out. It was like hyper-converged upstart Stratascale raises $32 million. I was like, whoa, 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 wait a minute. What happened here? And they already had $10 million before. And what is the weirdest part that I found in the news was that the investment comes from Intel, Cisco, and SanDisk. Wow.
It's called an incubator.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you look at it this way. All right. So I've seen this type of investment come before, where it's a seed investment in specific technologies around something that has a true differentiator compared to other players in the space, right? If you look at, Intel makes some interesting investments. I think that Intel's making an investment in like Maxta, right? Threw some big money at them because it's a software play. And there's some interesting stuff around what they might be able to do in the kernel space and how you could kind of integrate that into the chip space. Cisco invested in Whiptail or Invicta before they purchased them. Oracle invested in Pillar prior to them bringing them in. So sometimes those are seed investments like, hey, we kind of have an understanding that we like this technology. We're not ready to buy it outright, but we can invest in you a little early and see where it goes. If we throw $10 million at you, that's not a lot of money for a company that has $50 billion in the bank. Doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to buy them or that it's going to have a big significant return on investment. From what I understand, what Stratoscale is doing is a lot different compared to what the traditional hyper-converged solutions that are out there in the market taste today. They're leveraging most of their technologies off of the current, the hypervisors, i.e. Hyper-V, KVM, and VMware, and getting the most of their value add in from those technologies. Stratoscale appears to be using KVM, but there's also a significant amount of intellectual property themselves around how they orchestrate and deliver and leverage OpenStack. It's kind of like an OpenStack appliance the way Nebula was, but it looks like it's going to be more of a full stack that's going to implement into it. Still don't know a whole lot yet because I haven't had a chance to talk with anybody from there yet. And it's kind of my thing, hyper-converged, for the most part, because I've had good discussions with pretty much all the players in the field.
Yeah. Guys, come and talk to us, because I was trying to do a bit of digging around it, trying to find what that unique value is or that differentiator. And I really struggled to find it. The only thing that I picked up on, and this is not really a major differentiator, I don't think, but was that they make a big play on containers, so Docker. Whereas a lot of the guys currently don't make a big noise about that, although they could potentially run containers. All I got was high-performance storage, cloud services, containers, and virtualization on a single platform. Oh, and check this out, right? It scales from 4 nodes to the entire data center. How's about that for scaling, eh?
That's, everybody can scale that way, didn't you know that? Everything is distributed shared, nothing.
Yeah, but check this out as well. I always love this single pane of glass for management. I've got 3 monitors in the office here. I don't want a single pane of glass. I want 3. Sorry.
Oh, no, I totally. I mean, that's part of that's the message around hyper-converged infrastructure. It's a simplicity. That's what they're selling, right? I'm going to sell you a simplistic management model, a simple deployment model, a simple cost structure. And you're going to turn around and put segment X of your workloads on top of it. And that's the better value prop that those groups can bring to it. Are they going to replace every workload in the data center? No. Are they going to scale to the levels that somebody like an AT&T needs? No. Can they come in and do some dev work and some of these other things? Yeah, for sure. And they can take over some production workloads in certain organizations, in certain spaces. I see a tremendous amount of success in the SLED space, the small government space, city governments. They love this stuff because they have 1 or 2 IT guys in some of these places, and, they can do all their IT in 6 and 8U. Now, if you're somebody like an Amgen or, some of these larger organizations or the Fortune 500, you may see a use case here and there for it, but it's not going to be your primary IT platform.
Help me out here, right? I couldn't put my finger on what the major differentiator would be between those guys and somebody like Nutanix or Simplivity. I dug around it, and I couldn't find it.
It'll probably be in the way that they orchestrate and deliver workloads and how they implement or deliver the platform. Have they built in significant backup and replication piece that doesn't need third-party software? Do they have a really elegant orchestration layer that will allow you to provision multiple types of workloads, leveraging specific APIs and RESTful work, right? It's each one of these companies, be it Simplivity or Pivot or Scale or Nutanix, they all have a sweet spot that, isn't readily apparent unless you have spent a lot of time in that space. Nutanix has good scalability. They're great for VDI. They started to target tier one workloads and brought some really sharp people in to come work and develop the use case around that. And they're hypervisor agnostic for the most part. So they're kind of ahead of everybody else in terms of mind share, marketing buzz, and investment dollars. And then you look at the Simplivity space, and it's, they have a very good solution for smaller organizations and some very amazing stuff around their storage capabilities with how they do duplication compression. It allows them to do backup and replication unlike any other organization can. If you have a 5-minute RPO and RTO for your organization, that's the platform you would want to leverage if it was virtualized. And then you get Scale, who's a little more segmented towards a small SMB space. And then there's others like Pivot and Nimbox, who just came out. I mean, this space is starting to get crowded. And then, of course, you get the Evo Rail group that come along. And now every OEM has a hyper-converged solution that they can sell.
Exactly. And that's why these guys are a little bit later to market here. And it wasn't, just to me, it wasn't obvious what the differentiator was going to be. I'm not saying that it's not there. I just couldn't see it. And with that, I'm kind of like, meh.
Well, late to market never means that they're not going to make it.
I just think it makes it a little bit more difficult when, you know, you've got an early market. I know NetApp's probably the quintessential example here. They came in and they chiseled out a market, staked their flag in the ground, and they were very, very difficult to move from that market leader position. In fact, arguably, they probably never were moved out of that slot.
Nope.
The likes of Nutanix and people got huge head start there, and that is some ground that needs making up. And a lot of the big players now, not just off the back of EvoRail, right, but a lot of the big players now have their own offerings within that space. It's a market that's maturing at a rapid clip, I think.
Well, it's also the ability to execute. And, you know, if I'm an HP or a Dell or IBM or a Cisco or somebody of that nature, my sales process is drastically different than a startup. I can come from the top down and shovel stuff in. I can seed units and get them in there. I have, you know, drastic amounts of disposable income at my side to, you know, capture a market space where I think it's going to get hot, versus a startup, even a well-funded startup, who primarily the sale is going to come from the bottom up. They're not going to have those kind of relationships always with, you know, not going to be able to walk into a JP Morgan and say, hey, we see you have this project, try 40 of these systems. You know, you have those barriers to entry around being an unknown, even if you've been in the marketplace for 3 or 5 years. You know, the support, the risk aversion in this space is so high for larger organizations that it's tough to overcome that. And I saw it on a day-to-day basis, you know, firsthand. Yeah.
Hey, Gabriel, since you're working at a vendor, I'm going to fire this question at Hans. Hans, your understanding of the market and of customers at the moment, are customers looking in the hyper-converged space to best-of-breed vendors, if I can call them that, the startups and maybe the one-trick ponies, or are they looking to the more established vendors to answer their hyper-converged needs?
Well, it depends a lot on the type of customer you have. If you do... From within the techies themselves, they would really love to work with those startups because they have the head start technology-wise. They understand the market. They understand the problem better than the A-brand vendors. On the other side, you have the decision makers. And I've worked a lot in pre-sales, and I know where those issues happen, and the issues happen with, oh, but we cannot buy from this vendor because it's not on our list of approved vendors. And this is now slowly changing with, for example, the SimpliVity card now available in a UCS platform, with the Dell partnership with Nutanix, with the EvoRail available for all the A brands. That is slowly gonna change a lot to the decision makers. So I think that's a big move. I'm not sure there is a big difference between deciding for a startup or an A-brand vendor today anymore, specifically speaking about the ones that do have mature products. So then, not about these new ones that no one ever heard of, but a SimpliVity, a Scale, and a Nutanix. I think they have the credibility today in a market towards the customers. They are being in the market for at least 3 years shipping now, have enough installations in the fields. I think the credibility is there.
Fair play. Gabriel, usually, do you have anything you want to say on that?
Not usually. Once you're on the Gartner Magic Quadrant, you have some viability in the mindset of that kind of decision-maker marketplace. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be long-term successful. Go look at some of the older Gartner Magic Quadrants around, you know, cloud. It's interesting to see where that marketplace went. In fact, I think I'd wrote in a piece a long time, a while back, about, you know, how when AWS came to marketplace and finally made it onto Gartner, they were like in the bottom left part of the quadrant. 3 years later, they were one of only 4 or 5 people left standing. And, you know, now that, you know, that's how quickly. And, you know, really, that is kind of quickly in technology scape, things can change. I mean, you look at Cisco and UCS, 2009, people are laughing. 2010, HP's writing articles about, we won't even know what UCS is in a year. Well, look at it today. You know, so it's one of those things where you can't really, it's so hard to make judgments on what product or what technology is going to win out.
Did you just make a point of one competitor writing badly about another as being a valuable opinion?
It wouldn't be the point.
Seriously,
right? I mean,
I've heard Gartner and IDC make those mistakes, but a vendor, of course, they're going to say that and they're going to be wrong. But HP does it all the time.
But when you have your lunch eaten, it's a little bit different. It's one thing to say it's like, you know, this new flash upstart storage company, they'll never sell a box. But when they take, you know, when they take a number one position over you, there's a lot of crow to be eaten there, right? And, you know, obviously, you know, the major companies are always going to be, it's always competitive at that scale. But it does make you kind of look silly. And I think sometimes discretion is, you know, you really don't even need to comment.
Yeah, absolutely. But do you know what, Gabriel? Do you have any idea how much I despise the Gartner Magic Quadrant? I cannot believe you.
I will send you a great, great graphic. And we'll put it on. I'll put it on maybe the LinkedIn group. But I'll send you a great graphic on how vendors see the Magic Quadrant versus how everyone else does. It's actually pretty funny.
Yeah, you know what? One of my main gripes is. And this isn't necessarily Gartner or the vendor's fault, but so often customers don't realize that Magic Quadrants, it's about the vendor rather than the technology. So they will look at at All Flash, let's say, and they'll say, oh, look, Extreme.io. And I'm not picking on Extreme.io here, but Extreme.io is up there. Well, actually, it's EMC as a company that are up there. And it includes more than just a single product. And it's not just about the technology. Of course, it's about that ability to execute and take to market and what have you. But, sorry, I don't want us to get sidetracked on Gartner Magic Quadrants.
No worries. Okay. As somebody who had to go through the process themselves and had to actually speak to Gartner reps and how it's positioned and how that process works, I say there are pros and cons to it. It is definitely an interesting... it's probably one of the more interesting things I've had to do in my career, and it is a lot of value and insight into having to be part of it. But I can see from both sides on how it can be a double-edged sword.
And you know what? I've been at so many briefings with CEOs at startups and people, and if Gartner have been in the room, almost without doubt, the CEO will stand at the front and he'll be like, thanks for everybody for coming, and thanks to our friends from Gartner at the back. No. Not your friends, okay? Let's not be cozying up to them and just... Anyway.
You are paying them.
Shall we move on? I want to just switch gears a little bit here, right? So a little bit more of a lighter note in some respects at least. Cloud Physics, there was talk about a Cloud Physics paper out recently. I think it was a paper that gave a bunch of stats about the industry. So for instance, check some of these out, right? Cloud Physics says that 26% of space in vSphere environments is dead.
Yep.
Can believe that, right?
Confirmed.
I'm surprised it's not higher, actually. But let me run through some of these here. Here's another interesting one. 16% of virtual machines are unused. I can vouch for that from experience. Doing storage consolidation and, not consolidation, but space reclamation projects in previous companies, one of the easiest wins is get the vSphere guys to go out there, scan their estate and find out how many virtual machines they've got that either haven't been powered on for 6 months or have had nobody log on and the likes for 6 months, and you can claim back a ton of storage space there.
Yep.
What else have we got? 25% of all Windows VMs will be out of support next year. Wow. And... oh, yeah, look at this as well. 22% of vSphere 5.5 servers are still vulnerable to Heartbleed SSL, yeah?
How many 5.5 servers are there in the field? I mean, there's going to be, but not every environment. Not every environment, and a lot of them, especially in enterprise, are not on 5.5 yet.
Yeah, I agree with that. Hey, this is an interesting one as well, though. If we take this in the context of 26% of space in vSphere environments is dead, then also 43% of organizations apparently risk downtime every week due to potential out-of-space conditions on disk. So on one hand, we're saying 26% of all space in a vSphere environment is dead space, it's unused. But then on the other hand, nearly half of organizations are risking downtime every week because they're about out of disk. That's bad management, I guess. I mean, that's chronically bad management.
So happens in the last 2 to 3 weeks with a customer, and I see their environment and they're having a new EMC VNX 5300 under their ESX servers, and I see they're using NAS. I'm like, okay, why are you using NFS? Let alone that, I see that you are not using your VAI plugin. Do you know what the impact is of that on TIM provisioning and so on, and space reclamation and bloody, bloody, blah? And we're like, we're not doing TIM provisioning. I was like, really? Yeah, we don't want to over-provision our storage. I'm like, have you seen how much dead space there is in even in your C drive? And it's crazy. But even if you're using TIM provisioning, and that's actually why I wanted to talk about this, that 26% of disk space is dead. At one of my last customers, I looked at, the array was filling up. It was a three-part array. The array was filling up, and we saw an imbalance between what was really used in vSphere and what was used on a three-part array. And we said, well, something's wrong here. And basically, it was the TCHAN unmap and the deletes in the SCSI delete commands that were not going through the whole stack from within the guest up to the disks way below in a three-part. And with making sure that everything, there's a lot of manual labor there, deleting and cleaning and zeroing out in your guest and then in the VMDKs and your data store and down to the volume, the LUN and down to the disks, I managed to reclaim 5 terabytes of data of a 31 terabyte array.
Yeah, and that's
you
not
should
uncommon.
Have bought VCOps.
but that's not uncommon, Hans. I've done exactly the same in previous jobs as well, and bad management like that and people not risking, in quotes, okay, thin provisioning and the likes, makes it so easy for consultants to go into a place and look good. Like, no kidding, a 30-odd terabyte array and you've reclaimed 5 terabytes of storage. I know that it's quite a manual job, you were saying, but it's bread and butter stuff today, surely.
In one aspect, though, you get a lot of people who's like, hey, you know, I'm so focused on just keeping the lights on and keeping the systems running that I don't have the same level of, you know, anal, minutia-based mindset in going in and, you know, cultivating or crafting through my environment, right? Sometimes it's very easy to basically just continue to, you know, hey, nothing's broken, things are working okay, you know, let's just keep on trucking until there is a problem. A lot of IT is very reactionary. It's not proactive. And because being proactive is tough and it requires a lot of insight. And there aren't really great, great tools, at least, you know, I'm sure there are, you know, getting better, but there's never been a really great tool for a holistic look at my entire environment and proactively help me adjust things on the fly or on a quarterly basis to get the best bang for buck out of the assets I have in place, because there are so many disparate pieces in your traditional IT stack.
So, and it's really easy for us, right, as external consultants or whatever we are on the outside, to say, God, these guys are doing a terrible job managing their estates. Mm-hmm. You know, they're probably under the cosh, understaffed and all of that. But in today's world, I mean, things like VAAI, those primitives, right? It's not like they're new anymore.
Well, but they're not the same for everyone. And that's actually, if you'll allow me to shameless plug here to a blog post that I wrote, and actually it's not that big of a deal that I wrote it, but
I'll edit this out. No, I'm just kidding. Go on.
No, I'm actually asking for feedback. Because what I have noticed is that although you may have VAAI status, not all of the arrays support the delete status. So, right. anyone that is out there that has VAI implemented or not, even if you don't have it, I would still love the feedback. I wrote the blog on October 27th called vSphere Storage Array Feedback Requested. And I just need 5 points. So the vendor model, vSphere version, VAI status, thin provisioning status, and delete status. I've given the screenshots and the scripts to it. And I already have some VMAX, Nimble, Pure, HP Store Virtual, Ecologic, Compellent, and 3PAR. If you have any other array, please get in there and comment with your, because I want to make that whole case for people. Not everyone is on server 2012 in the guests. Not everyone has vSphere 5.x. I want to make it transparent for everyone to be able to reclaim all that dead space from within the guest up to the disks down below.
What do you mean not everybody's on server 2012? 25% of all VMs will be end of support next year.
I know.
That's not even just not on 2012. That's end of support.
Yes. Yes.
And anyway, we're kind of getting down into the weeds, and this is our weekly news show, really. We're thinking about spinning off another show that gets down into the weeds. So let's just let's jump up out of the weeds again. I thought that was going to be, you know, a bit of a light-hearted discussion, but we're getting into primitives and screenshots and stuff. All cool, but I think let's shift back to the news a bit now. So there was an interesting article in The Register talking about Nexenta, who are now in at a company called WePro, something like that?
WePro, very large service integrator out of India. Last I recall it, it was something around approaching 200,000 employees, maybe larger.
Yeah, so I've got 150,000 employees in my notes here, and one of the top 10 IT services companies in the world. So shame on me for not knowing. But yeah, those guys, I was going to say, have bought into Nexenta in a big way here. But an organization like that, right, I do fully appreciate that they are probably the customer of just about every storage and every server and every hypervisor vendor out there. Nonetheless, a fairly high-tier app, I think, for VDI or cloud-based desktops for their customers, they're going to be running it off Nexenta. So I thought that was an interesting story there.
Yeah, I'd like to hear more details around that, because, I mean, I think that if, from my experiences with working with them, you know, they do buy a little bit of everything. They have standardized in the past, I believe, on vBlock systems for some of their larger customers and deployments. Doesn't mean that they can't leverage, a roll your own or, you know, an Nexenta type stack on the storage side for other pieces. Not sure if the 50,000 desktop solution they're getting ready to provision for a healthcare company is going to be run on Nexenta versus something else. You know, the devils are usually in the details with those announcements and those deals. And, you know, we all have a lot of good friends that work at Nexenta. So, I mean, I would love to see more detail around what those deals look like, because, you know, they've been plugging along for a while now. You know, they came out with the vSAN integration part where you could basically leverage NFS and a few in snapshots and a bunch of other stuff on top of vSAN, which I thought was really cool. They're definitely making a big push to get into a lot of other, you know, OEM, OSM type groups to leverage the technology. That particular software defined or the software storage marketplace is pretty challenging to be long-term longevity, as well as to get production level classification for a lot of the customer base that they would want to reach out to.
Yeah. I think a lot of those alliance partnerships are coming from the way that Tarkan Maynor wants to run the show. He's really a partner and an ecosystem man, as previously it was more of, we want to have our product and our product out. And Tarkan Maynor understands the value of working with an ecosystem of partners. And we see a lot of Nexenta buzz left and right in new deals. And I like that. I like that about the product is a good fit for that.
I'm pretty excited for them, because I don't know how many years ago it was now, but I remember the first time I downloaded the Nexenta Store product, the Community Edition. Mm-hmm. I think back then, the term software-defined storage probably wasn't even fully coined, but I was really excited to download it and play with it in the lab. And I did that, I mean, I do genuinely remember being excited about this. A storage guy, right? A few machines in the lab at home, like just, you know, x86 servers and PCs. And I was able to run a proper storage system on there without having to buy a ton of hardware. I thought, this is awesome. But I really quickly lost interest in them because they just didn't seem to be doing enough at the time. And they really dropped off my radar. But recently, taking a closer look at them, I mean, they are broadening and fattening out that product portfolio there. They're not a one-trick pony company anymore.
No, I would agree. I think they really have. They've started to kind of come into their own, and they have great relationships with some of the smaller ODMs, the manufacturers of systems that you probably don't know the name of. And so at that aspect of it, they're starting to get more penetration. Are they getting the same level of penetration as a traditional storage vendor? Probably not. You're still probably going to see a lot more. If I was to hazard a guess, I would probably think that you probably see more free, you know, more spinning disk on FreeNix versus Pagenda.
So I spoke to them last week, actually, on that topic of how much is on the community edition versus the enterprise edition. And they said it's pretty close to being a 50-50 split.
Which is good.
Yeah, that is good. But you know what? I think I've classed them for so long alongside HP and Left Hand. They had such a great potential to get a leg up on the market, being one of the very first software-defined storage plays, just like Left Hand. And I think inside of me, personally as a technologist, I was just a bit disappointed that they didn't capitalize on that. And only now that the market seems to be growing and exploding and everybody's got to have a software-defined version of their storage product, only now do they seem to be really kicking in with their game and widening that portfolio and winning some decent deals. Maybe I'm being unfair to them there. I don't know.
No. You bring up a good point by adding Left Hand to the story here. And I think one of the differentiators was that the Left Hand was provided through an appliance, and you could
appliance
just
model.
You could just deploy. It was very easy to deploy the Left Hand in a lab. As to the Nexenta, you still have to understand what you're doing. It is a manual installation. You have to create the zills. You have to know what you're doing. But it performs a lot better than a Left Hand. But it's still, you had to be more technical and more upfront focused about what you were doing, as in a Left Hand, you could just deploy that. And I think that's a big differentiator in adoption.
Plus supportability and, you know, ecosystem and infrastructure. I mean, you know, Nexenta having its own backing versus Left Hand having HP's backing as a product.
Absolutely.
I mean, and look what's happened to Left Hand. It's free now.
Yeah.
Right? Let's not go there again.
To a certain capacity, I think, right?
Yes.
But we're kind of coming towards the hour mark, guys. So I think one more thing I'd like to discuss before we close out the show. There's a Forbes article out there at the moment, which I just thought was absolutely hilarious as I read it. It's talking about EMC with Extreme.io versus Pure Storage. And it talks, the premise of the article is these guys compete with each other a lot, right? And it says, well, they're quoting EMC as saying, we win 95% of the time against Pure Storage. And then on the other hand, they're quoting Pure Storage saying, we win the vast majority of the time when we compete against EMC. And it's like, at a high level, what? You can't be winning 95% of the time and the other guy winning the vast majority of the time. What the hell's going on there?
60% of the time, it works every time.
Yeah, the only real thing you can get out of this article is that both are head to head 90% of the time.
Yeah, and they don't like each other.
Of course they don't. But I mean, I don't believe the numbers from either side. I don't care about those type of numbers from either side. But the fact that EMC specifically says that, except of ignoring the fact that it happens, means a lot.
What? Accepting the fact that they compete with Pure?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
So more and more. And this is what Pure wants. this is what Pure has been after since the beginning of attacking EMC, is making sure EMC acknowledges them. And that has been, that has taken them a long time. And now every single time EMC speaks about competitors, they're speaking about Pure Storage. In the end, Pure wins.
Fair play. Now, I did do a bit of digging around those quotes, okay? Just for the listeners, right? It seems, okay, in my understanding of the digging I've done, that EMC is saying they win 95% of the time when it's Extreme.io versus Pure. Whereas the Pure statement that they win the vast majority of the time could include the times that they compete against VNX,
yes,
and VMAX and other products. That said, though, if EMC does win 95% of the time when it's straight Extreme.io versus Pure, that's got to be worrying for Pure. Now, I'm not saying that that is the case, but that's certainly what the article seems to intimate when you dig a bit deeper.
That's because EMC's sales teams, if they go head-to-head with Extreme.io against the Pure, chances are that the EMC sales hand will win. If you go head-to-head Pure against VNX, chances are that technology will take the upper hand, and then Pure might win.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, and why would you say that technology would win when it's Pure versus VNX, but not Pure versus Extreme?
Let me rephrase. The sales teams of EMC have a bigger hand in the customer than the Pure teams have today.
Oh, no doubt. Oh,
so yeah. Pure needs to work harder to win their deals. Where have they the bigger hand in the deal? It's where their technology is better and where they actually are helping the customer, which is where they come in with an all-flash, where previously there was not an all-flash. So if they're competing against a non-all-flash, they might win on the technology part.
I would hazard a guess that Pure's bigger wins against EMC have been against VMAX renewals,
and
specific. I mean, that's kind of like the easy analysis to make. If it's Pure versus Extreme.io, you know, I don't know exactly. It's hard to believe either one, but you know what? It's like Shakespeare wrote some of those press releases because they're intricate. You really have to understand that what they're saying has been vetted and crafted in such a way, actually accurate, but totally full of crap.
Yeah. You know, I did wonder as well, Extreme.io hasn't been a GA product for that long in the market, to be honest. So a lot of Pure's wins could have been before Extreme.io was a GA product. Now that Extreme.io is a GA product, maybe they're winning less. The reason that you just made me think of that there, actually, Gabriel, because when you're saying most of the wins were probably against VMAX, surely then EMC would be aware that, you know, Pure are coming in against a VMAX renewal. We're not shaping up so well against them, so let's bring in the Extreme.io box. Now, they couldn't do that, let's say, 6 to 12 months ago, but they can. Surely they would do that now. You know, they would never look at Nick, because EMC are all over their accounts. We'll give them awesome credit there, okay? Anytime they're looking to lose a VMAX deal to Pure, surely they'd be, like, rolling in the extremes.
Oh, most certainly. It's not always that an all-flash is the proper replacement for the VMAX. It may be, maybe the VMAX customer doesn't buy another engine. You know, or they don't extend support for one frame.
Yeah.
They just replace part of it. It's a lot different.
That's a good point, yeah. So, guys, let's close out the podcast. I think we've had a great discussion. Hans, at the top of the podcast, you mentioned you're going to make in some personal investment into bringing yourself up to speed around OpenStack, which I think is an awesome thing to do, and I'd highly recommend that to anybody who's not all over OpenStack at the moment. I think this year we've been hit with two pretty cool technologies. Docker hit the scene, you know, in some style. OpenStack, I know OpenStack didn't hit the scene this year, but it's really starting to come of age. Just a straw poll, right? Of those two technologies, if you're a kind of infrastructure techie guy and you think you've got the time to learn one of them, which one would you learn first, Docker or Extreme.io, Docker or OpenStack?
OpenStack. Because
I think
Docker is probably going to hit more the programmers and developers. I'm an infrastructure guy that needs to look up. What's the first thing I see when I look up? It's automation, and it's hybrid, and it's all that, and everything on top of that. Docker for me is still one level up higher.
You agree, Gabriel?
Totally agree. You know, for me, Docker is something you layer on top of your virtualization environment for specific workloads, unlike OpenStack, which can be much more integral to your overall IT infrastructure ecosystem as a whole, right? You can build a lot more of your workflow and line of business applications and everything that you need to run your business on top of an OpenStack implementation. Whereas in Docker is something that's complementary to that or to your virtualized environment for specific use cases, but not necessarily all. You know, I think OpenStack hits the same challenge around, I would hazard a guess that maybe 80% of the companies out there on the marketplace today have no need for OpenStack, nor would it benefit them greatly. And I'd probably say the same is even higher for Docker organizations, right? It is very specific and very niche-y, at least at this phase it is in today, because there's such a heavy barrier to entry for organizations to implement those types of technologies.
I think that the barrier is heavier for OpenStack than it is for Docker, though. I think Docker is very simple compared to OpenStack. And I don't mean that in a bad way, but OpenStack is looking to address a lot more than a container technology.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's a workload versus an infrastructure.
Well, gentlemen, it's been an absolute pleasure. And if you're a listener as well, thanks for joining and listening in on the show. Feel free to come and hang out with us, like Hans said at the beginning of the show, on Facebook, LinkedIn, and wherever the heck we land in the future as well. So let's round this episode out with another film review for geeks. Computer. Access movie database from the early 21st century and show me films that are related to space.
Enter authorization code.
Authorization code Poulton Alpha 386.
Searching.
Okay, what have we got? Avatar, Elysium, Gravity, Interstellar. That sounds good. Computer, load film Interstellar, Christopher Nolan, 2013, into Holodeck 3, please.
Holodeck 3 program is ready.
Okay, so I saw Interstellar last week while I was in San Jose. And what a film. Seriously, it was so good that I clapped at the end. Now, I'm not going to spoil the finish for you here, so if you've not seen it yet, you should be safe. The setting for the film is, well, it's in the future, and conditions on Earth are so bad that we need to find a new place to live. And by a new place, we mean a new planet. Quality stuff, right? Raging dust storms are sweeping the Earth, wrecking crops and devastating health. So, we need to move to the stars. And it's got wormholes, black holes, spaceships, relativity, and hints of time travel. And if that kind of storyline doesn't appeal to techie folks, then I don't know what does. And the special effects are pretty damn good as well. And to top it off, they pretty much nail the ending. There was one point when I thought the ending was going to be a disappointment, but it absolutely wasn't. So if you're a techie, I think you'll love this film. I'd rate it as a must-see for all techie geeks. Oh, and it's Christopher Nolan, right? And as a Nolan fan, for the most part, I thought it delivered. So, if you're not necessarily a sci-fi person, but you like Nolan's other works like Inception and The Prestige, then I really think you'll like this.
Captain, we are being hailed.
Put it on the screen.
We are the Borg. Lower your shields and surrender your ships.
Ah, red alert. All hands to battle stations. Kill that transmission. Mr. Worf.
Captain.
Arm phases and load all torpedo bays. Mr. Data, prepare to open an encrypted socket on port 22 to the Borg vessel and initiate the buffer overrun.